This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm Ji Soo Ki. Fantastic to be with you on the first Monday of 2020. As always, thanks for keeping it right here on WGN Radio. Coming up on the show, are you in a relationship currently? And did you know that usually only one partner in the relationship takes care of all of the finances? And we'll tell you why that they may, that may not be a good thing. And Elise Glink, CEO of Best Money Moves, will be telling us, elaborating on that topic. But right now, we have the senior editor, Jim Dalkey, and associate editor, Catherine Davis, in studio with us from Chicago Inno. And we're going to be talking all about the great Chicago startups. And we're going to have a roundup of all the fantastic money that was raised this past year in 2019. But first, let's start with a very good story about a local car insurance company that Clear Cover is the name. And they just had a huge investment.
That's right. Yeah. So late last week, Clear Cover raised $50 million, bringing their total funding to more than $104 million.
So for a startup, for me, that sounds like a lot of money. But for a startup, is that average? Is that chump change? Is that, oh, that's good? We can wait a little while before we have to raise more money.
So this is their third funding round. And so usually for a Series C, especially in a town like Chicago, $50 million is pretty significant. Nothing to balk or to...
Yeah. Bulk at, right?
Right. The interesting thing about Clear Cover is that they're kind of part of a growing group of insurance companies here in Chicago. Clear Cover focuses on car insurance specifically. So, you know, they have figured out a way to make car insurance essentially cheaper, mainly by, you know, cutting down on operations costs, marketing costs, distribution costs. And they're really kind of taking aim and trying to compete with the Allstates and the Geicos of the world.
I was going to say, so they're going to compete against Flo. What is the Gecko and the Havoc guy?
That's a great point. And that's exactly what they're competing against. They're competing against heavy, heavy marketing dollars that every insurance company is willing to spend, right? I mean, you cannot go through a segment on TV without seeing the Aflac, Geico, State Farm.
Yeah, I forgot about the duck.
Every insurance company is massively spending. And so that's kind of what's up against a lot of these digital startups. Nevertheless, ClearCover has really found a niche here and has grown really quickly. They're up to over 120 employees here in Chicago. Really a fast-growing startup that just launched a few years ago.
That's so cool. I wouldn't even think there would be room in the market to compete against such huge giants in an industry like car insurance.
If you can compete on price, that will acquire customers, right? So their biggest struggle is getting in front of customers. So marketing will be a tricky thing for them as they're competing against the guys with really, really deep pockets. But clearly they are kind of showing early traction and, you know, would not be surprised to kind of see a large insurer potentially try to acquire these guys down the road. The more traction they get, the more market share they're able to take.
So we're talking about money, $50 million. You know, let's talk about a roundup of, you guys did a nice roundup last week of the top 12 biggest funding that happened
That's right. Clear Cover, who we just spoke about, actually was on the list that we just put together. They raised $43 million at the beginning of last year. So another large funding round for them. And they were a part of one of the 12 largest VC funding rounds that Chicago saw last year. That list was led by Tempus. Tempus is a healthcare startup in Chicago led by Eric Lukofsky, who's the founder of Groupon. Tempus is basically working to cure cancer, long story short. And they do some really interesting genomic sequencing and artificial intelligence and kind of tailoring treatments to patients to kind of help target specific types of cancer. And they raised $200 million of funding last year, valued at over $3 billion. They are Chicago's most valuable tech startup. And so they kind of led the year with a $200 million round.
Well, I'm excited to talk about some other startups that raised a lot of money, including a celebrity shout-out app and non-alcoholic spirits. So these are spirit-free cocktails. They're no longer called mocktails, everybody. And there's a lot of money behind them and this movement. But back on the Winter's Business Lunch here with Jim Dalkey and Catherine Davis, both from Chicago Inno. So let's continue our discussion on all these startups that raised a lot of money last year.
Yeah. So one other was Cameo. You know, they're kind of one of Chicago's most buzzy consumer apps right now. They specialize in celebrity shout outs. So essentially, if you want to, you know, give your friend a birthday wish from Snoop Dogg, you can literally buy that.
And it really will be Snoop Dogg that does the wish.
Yes.
It's not computer generated or altered or.
No, okay. It is him recording himself on, I mean, I guess his cell phone. But last year they raised $50 million, which was one of the year's biggest funding rounds. And, you know, it really goes to show how quickly they're growing. They've only been around for, I think, a couple years at this point. But raising this kind of money is pretty significant and kind of shows investors see promise in this business.
Okay, what's another one?
Another startup I really like on this list, AMP Americas. They raised $75 million. They're a clean energy startup. And what they have done is developed a solution that turns cow waste into renewable natural gas for trucking fleets. So long-haul trucking companies can use what's essentially cow poo that has been turned into fuel for their trucks.
Well, this is fascinating. Clean energy, this has been an area that's seen a lot of growth.
It has, and it has in the Midwest as well. So we're seeing a lot of that activity happen here in Chicago. We have the Clean Energy Trust, which is a kind of a local VC firm accelerator program around here that invests in a lot of companies like that. AMP America is a really interesting company. They've now raised over $130 million. And so what's interesting about this list that we put together is it's really indicative of Chicago's kind of startup DNA. There's healthcare companies on here, clean energy companies on here,
consumer
apps.
Here.
Spot Hero is another company on this list that raised $50 million last year. You probably use them if you try to find a parking place around town, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Spot Hero has really kind of become
the way to go.
It is. And there are a few different companies that are doing sort of parking on demand, mobile parking via your cell phone. But, they've kind of really become the market leader for consumer parking. And so, business software is another example. Vistex is a company that raised $65 million last year. So, and then insurance, Kin Insurance and ClearCover also raised big bucks last year. So those, kind of make up a lot of the activity that we typically see kind of in Chicago's growing startup scene.
Is there another one you wanted to mention off the list?
Yeah, Fast Radius is an interesting one. They are a Chicago manufacturing startup. They raised $48 million, led by UPS. And so that's interesting because logistics is a big booming industry in Chicago. Four Kites is another business that raised $50 million last year. They do logistics as well. So we're seeing a lot of tech companies kind of pop up around logistics. And not surprising, right? Chicago has long been a hub for logistics. It's a big, big area for lots of different companies in terms of moving items across the country. Not surprising to see a lot of tech startups kind of pop up to support that industry and a lot of money going into those businesses as well.
I mentioned it earlier, the Zero Proof Spirits. This has been a big movement in large part spurred on by healthy millennials. I believe it's the younger generation that is saying, okay, I want to go out for a nice cocktail, but I don't want to feel really bad the next day.
Right. Yeah. The sober movement is something I think people have been talking about for the last few years, as you just see kind of more and more, sparkling water is really trending and wellness is such like a huge, concept that people are really, contributing in their own lives. And so what we're seeing here in Chicago is a new beverage company called Ritual. And basically what they do is they make non-alcoholic gin and whiskey spirits. And so when I talked to the founders, the idea behind it was, it's a Tuesday after work and you want to have kind of that sensation of a cocktail, but not the hangover the next day. And this is kind of the perfect thing to do that with.
Well, I love the spirit-free cocktails. I'm not completely pro them all the time, but I think they're appropriate, especially if you aren't someone that's drinking, if you are living a sober lifestyle. But I think it's great to mix them up with alcoholic beverages, too. And they're very tasty because they're distilled with natural botanicals that really kind of simulate the burn that you would even get with some spirits, which
right.
I think is nice.
Yeah, Ritual, they say that their gin features English cucumber, juniper berry notes, along with mint and basil. So really kind of getting that traditional gin flavor.
And, you know, I don't think that these guys are just a flash in the pan or just a trend, right? And we kind of saw that today, because just today Ritual announced that they got an investment from Diageo, which is a large, large beverage business based in the UK. They are the beverage brand behind Crown Royal and Johnny Walker and Captain Morgan and Don Julio. And so they own a ton of very, very well-known alcohol brands. And now they've invested in what's essentially a non-alcoholic drink. So I think this shows you that this trend really is catching on, and the big beverage makers are seeing value in some of these non-alcoholic drinks.
So is Ritual a Louisville, Kentucky company, or is it, does it have ties here too?
So it's a Chicago-based company. All the founders are here, but they manufacture it in a facility in Louisville.
Got it. Okay. Well, this is definitely a, I think this is an area that we're going to just see a lot more growth.
I think so. I mean, it's January, right? A lot of people are doing dry January.
Sober January.
Yeah, after an overindulgent December, right? So I think that a lot of people are starting to kind of wake up and want to get a little bit more healthy in January. You're kind of starting your New Year's resolution. And hey, you know, a non-alcoholic cocktail could be one way to go.
Another area that is becoming more popular is corporate wellness. And I believe you told me now there is a place I can go to downtown to take a nap. Because we don't have napping rooms here at WGN Radio. Something
we don't have them at our office either.
Something we should look into. But what is this napping studio? And is this a real legitimate business?
Yeah, so the company is called Rejuve, short for rejuvenation, and they have new napping suites that they recently just opened in downtown Chicago, so located on the third floor of the Block 37 building. They have three different types of kind of napping suites, essentially, to let
and
people...
Block 37 is sort of this shopping mall...
Exactly, yeah. Right in the middle, mm-hmm. Kind of near State Street, you know, ton of shopping opportunities. And so, you know, Catherine and I were just talking about this earlier. I'm not sure that it makes sense if you wanted to take a nap to go outside your building. I think this as a building amenity within your own building's workspace, I think it makes a lot of sense. I'm not sure that I'm the type that would necessarily leave for a nap in the middle of the day.
You can't, because you're the senior editor. So you have to create the pace that everyone else follows.
The news isn't taking naps, so we're not taking naps either.
I can see this, though, especially if you, instead of going out for lunch, decide that you're exhausted or... Jasmine... My producer, Jasmine, was yawning. I just caught her yawning. On the other side of the glass. I think you could use this napping studio.
I'm interested. Very interested.
Because instead of maybe going out for lunch, you could go take a quick nap. It's 10, 15 minutes. They help you take a nap. And then you're rejuvenated, and it's about corporate wellness. You can get back to work and write that article.
And I think that this is a trend. I mean, you know, the outside of your office napping facilities are, you know, interesting depending on who's going to actually leave their office to use that. But in the Chicago tech and startup offices I've seen, it's definitely popular to have meditation rooms or napping rooms for your employees right there in the office, which I think makes a lot of sense, right? Because you don't obviously waste time traveling to a Rejuve, for instance, and then back to the office, you can do it kind of right there.
Catherine, you never look tired, but I think you are pro. You would do a nap.
Yeah,
maybe.
Jim, can we get some nap pods?
I think, you know, one thing that we're seeing is that this is indicative of the trend of just employees' mental health. Employers are increasingly, you know, focused on, you know, how is the mental and emotional well-being of my employees? What can we offer as a benefit, you know, to our workers to make this a better workplace? Now, you know, the devil's advocate part of this is, you know, you would hope that employers don't kind of abuse the nap pods by creating longer work days or expectations that require people to be at work longer and working harder, right? So, you know, it's nice to have an amenity like this, but if the expectation is you're at work till 8 or 9 p.m.
Right.
at night, that's maybe not exactly the kind of work-life balance we're looking for.
That is what I hear from my friends that do work for gigantic corporations that have ping pong tables and baristas and massage
parlors.
Yes, inside of but they want you there 24/7. They expect you to be
there.
And
that's why Google started to do that in the early days. They put a cafeteria.
Yeah, I wasn't going to mention them, Jim, but you mentioned them by name.
Google started that back in the day where they had food, they had places to rest, they have, you can get your doctors in the Google building. Yeah, but they want to keep you in the building as long as they possibly can.
So everyone's been talking about it, the Uber and Lyft congestion tax. What do you guys think?
Yeah, Uber and Lyft prices going up a little bit in Chicago. Actually, Chicago is one of the, if not the highest taxed ride-sharing city in the country now. And so what's happening is a single passenger ride in the city, it's going to be an extra $1.25. And the price actually goes down, though, if it's shared. So basically what the city is kind of hoping you're going to do is take an Uber pool, one of these shared rides, with the ultimate goal of reducing congestion. You know, when Uber and Lyft first started, I think there was this idea that they were going to alleviate a lot of traffic conditions because most people would be taking ride-sharing vehicles. Well, what it turned out is that they did not make traffic better, and in some cases, studies show that they're actually making traffic worse because there's a lot of people looking to be Uber drivers, trying to make a couple extra bucks, and now, especially in downtown kind of urban areas, traffic is actually getting worse because of Uber and Lyft. And so the city of Chicago looking to earn a little tax revenue here, obviously, but also hoping to cut down on congestion as well.
So hearing that it's $1.25 tax added to a single passenger trip, but then if you're headed downtown to Chicago, if the trip originates there or ends there in the Loop area, then another $1.75. So that could, that's where the $3 total is coming
from.
So the
biggest price increase really kind of in the city center, that's really not looking to raise prices kind of within the outskirts of the downtown area. So hoping to make kind of neighborhood rides still cost effective for you. But yeah, the increase is going to be if you're taking that ride kind of in the primetime areas in the Loop area of Chicago and downtown.
What have you guys heard about this? Are people, I mean, in terms of Uber and Lyft, I'm sure they're not happy about it. But then do you think it's going to be effective in terms of congestion?
I think it could definitely be effective in terms of congestion. You know, I hear a lot of people complaining about it, but I think it's kind of important to remember that, you know, Uber and Lyft is a pretty new concept. Like, how are you getting around before, like, 5 years ago?
Well, CTA, although they're suffering, right, because of
it. Well, that's part of this whole tax, right, is to push people towards the public transportation options, get more people on the bus, more people on the CTA.
Well, thank you so much to Senior Editor Jim Dalkey and Associate Editor Catherine Davis from Chicago Inno. Can you give the website?
Yeah, check us out at chicagoinno.com and sign up for The Beat, our daily email newsletter.
Well, thank you so much. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. This is G with you here on this Monday. I'm going to talk about the story, how to sell yourself in 30 seconds and leave people wanting more. Jasmine, is this something you'd want to do? Learn about?
Yeah. Let me go ahead and listen.
Because the key is you sell yourself in 30 seconds and you don't give it all away, and people continue to want more from you, which is very important when you're meeting somebody. You should definitely make eye contact. You should smile, introduce yourself. And did you know that it only takes about a few seconds before people decide whether or not they trust you or think that you're great for the job? So number one, you should know exactly where you want to go. So your elevator pitch should answer three questions. Who are you? What do you do? Where do you want to go? Or what are you looking for? You need to know exactly what you want to achieve, or no one can help you get there. So that's the first part of it. Then you need to bullet point it. So after studying your resume and LinkedIn profile, write down four bullet points that explain the direction you want to go. Think about the most relevant aspects of your work history, background, skills, and accomplishments that pertain to your goals. Make sure that each bullet relates back to your core message. Number three, very important, tell them a story. People love stories. It makes it easier for others to remember you later on if it's related to a story. Definitely eliminate jargon. When you're thinking about your elevator pitch, remember your audience. The best rule is to explain things simply and concisely. Make sure it invites conversation. It shouldn't lead to a dead end. The listener should feel compelled to continue engaging. You should also time yourself because you should respect your listener's time, especially if you're trying to ask for a promotion or you're looking for a new job. The listener should feel compelled to continue to engage with you, but then also shouldn't feel as though you're taking up too much of their time, so they're looking at their watch. Try to set a limit of 30 seconds. And finally, you should record yourself on video along with pitching your elevator pitch to your friends and colleagues.
That was a lot of information to take in. I will take that and see what I can do with it, because I'm a good storyteller, so I can introduce myself with a story and then to say, that was stupid. Well, so, hi, my name's Jasmine. Nice to meet you. You know that, like comedy.
The main thing is that you want to know what it is that you're trying to get out of a conversation, whether it's with a boss or a manager, whether you're applying for a new job or you're asking for investment money for your business. So you should know who you are, what you do, and where you want to go.
I mean,
and those are the basics.
Things. Yeah.
And then you should bullet point what you're trying to get out of it, and then be sure to practice your story without a lot of jargon. Make it simple, make it concise, make sure it's a conversation, but make sure it's not too long. You don't want to take up too much of their time. And then record yourself on video and practice with your friends and colleagues before you actually delve into your elevator pitch.
Sounds good to me.
I think it's good advice, no matter what you're doing.
Yeah, that's true.
Here with Elise Glink of thinklink.com and also Best Money Moves. Hi, Elise.
Hi, G.
You have a pretty, I think, hot topic on your hands to discuss for this segment.
Well, it's funny. After last week, you said to me, I want to talk more about this idea that, you know, some spouses and partners don't know anything about money and the other person controls that. And I think that's a perfectly legitimate way to, you know, think about it, how it goes for this new year.
Do you think that people still operate in their relationships where just one spouse is taking care of all the finances?
So the vast majority of marriages and long-term partnerships are actually like that. And one spouse does do it. And typically, it's a male-female heterosexual relationship, it's the man who does that. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why that is. Mm. I think that women of all ages seem to feel like they need to cede that control back over to their male counterparts. And you don't need to do that. And you really have to think about all of the expenses and costs and, you know, other things that go into making, you know, the financial arrangements that make a marriage or a partnership work. But even if you're in a same-sex partner, one typically manages everything financial and the other one doesn't. And I have a problem with that. And so whatever, you know, your gender, I think it's important that both people in a relationship have equal access to information and also have equal understanding of what the information is.
And especially important, I mean, heaven forbid that something happened to one of the partners, the other partner would be out of luck and not...
Oh, it's worse than that. I mean, devastated. Mm-hmm. I mean, really. I mean, I saw this firsthand. My own father dropped dead when he was 49. And what was interesting is my mom had always written, you know, managed the checkbook and bought stuff and managed the money. But even she didn't know quite how to get her arms around everything quickly. And of course, it was a long time ago before you actually had, you know, things like the cloud and places, easy places to store things on your phone. But, you know, watching my mother try to pull all these pieces together and then get a job, because of course, my dad was the person who contributed the income. She managed the kids and the house, but she ended up with this amazing career, a very lucrative career as a real estate agent for many, many years. Watching her do all that, it was really inspiring to me. And so I wrote a book a long time ago called 50 Simple Things You Can Do to Disaster-Proof Your Finances. And understanding all of these different pieces of a financial life is a first thing. But the problem, G, sometimes people don't even want to talk about it.
So if someone is listening right now and they are in a relationship where one partner is taking care of all of the finances, what are some small steps they can take to change this?
So years ago, I did this story for WGN-TV about all the makeup purchases that women hide from, you know, their husbands. I think you just got to come clean. And I think the best way to do this is over something that's really strong, liquid refreshment. And when you're both in a relaxed state and when you're by yourself, I don't think it's a good idea to have this conversation in public. Mm-hmm. Because you may want to express yourself like, oh, you didn't tell me you had $150,000 of student loan debt and we got married last week. Like, why did we take such an expensive honeymoon? I do think, though, having these kinds of conversations like about your credit, I think you should share your credit history, share your credit score, share the debts that you have and what the interest rate is. I mean, you've told me that you have where all your stuff is, mm-hmm. and what you owe and how much you owe. All that information should come out, and you should be able to have a real conversation on planning to pay down all of the debt, yours, his or hers and, you know, theirs, ours, how you're going to manage that going forward. And what are the most important financial goals that you have? Because if your biggest financial goal is you want to buy a really big house mm-hmm. and you want to take lots of trips, and my biggest goal is to get all of my debt paid down and have a pile of money in the bank, we may not be compatible despite what goes on in the bedroom.
What happens if you have this conversation and the partner isn't receptive?
Do you want to be with that person?
Wow, that's serious, huh?
It is, because what is it going to look like when you have to make your first financial decision, let's say to rent or to buy, or you're deciding on renovating a bathroom and, you know, your partner wants to go all hog in and is going to end up spending $25,000, but you think you can only afford $4,000. Like mm-hmm. figuring out where that spending is going and who, what priorities you both have. Seems to me the major priorities have to be in alignment or you're always going to be fighting.
What if you're in a relationship where there's a huge disparity of income? One person is making a lot of money and another person isn't making as much.
I think you have to talk about what that means in your relationship, because I think the person who doesn't make as much could feel, you know, easily less valued in the relationship. And I think you have to talk about what that means. And maybe money doesn't mean anything to the partner. They're just really, really good at making it. And maybe it means everything to you because you've hardly had any. Sharing those insights is super important. And again, this is part of, I think, relationship intimacy about money. Like sharing these details and these thoughts and your fears about it, it's just going to make for a stronger relationship, or it's going to help you figure out pretty quickly you're with the wrong person.
Thank you so much. Where do we find more information?
You can find lots of information on thinklink.com, or if you're interested in financial wellness for your business, go to bestmoneymoves.com.
Thanks, Elise.
It's a pleasure.
Elise always has great information. Amy Guth, host of the Crane's Daily Gist, is in studio with me right now. Hi, Amy.
Hi, how's it going?
Fantastic.
I'm just like fighting with my headphones over here. I can't hear a thing out of them.
I was wondering what was going on. You were wrangling.
I'm just going to take those off and talk to you.
Wrangling equipment.
There's a very long cord wrapped around this thing and whatever. Anyway, hello.
Hello.
Happy New Year.
I feel as though you can handle anything because you handle all the big stories that come your way.
Well, I try. I try.
So a lot. You've got some more info on the 737 MAX?
I mean, that's pretty much a thing you can say any day of the week, and I do.
It's a story that just keeps on giving.
It is. And so, you know, now it's looking like there are some more issues surfacing. Boeing is looking to take on a little more debt in order to cover all this. You know, they have a lot of planes that are sitting. They're not receiving payment for those planes because airlines, you know, aircraft carrier companies are not taking them, so they're not receiving payment. And they're sitting, and that requires money to store them. But also, through all of this increased scrutiny, there is possibly another issue. There are a couple of bundles of wires that might be too close together and might be impacting the safety of the tail of the aircraft. So it keeps going. So kind of a wait and see of what that's going to look like. In terms of both training for pilots, there's a lot more talk about what that's going to look like. Some pilots are saying, and some carriers, in fact, are saying, you know, pilots need start from the beginning kind of training with a flight simulator, like all of this. FAA initially resisted that, and now they're kind of on board with that idea. So there's a lot.
So this wiring helps control the tail of the 737 MAX. That sounds very
that's kind
crucial.
Of key. Yeah. The tail of the aircraft is kind of an important thing. So, you know, whatever. No big deal.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So there's that. And that's on the heels of, you know, just last week, I was talking about this on Crane's Daily Gist of when the CEO, Dennis Muilenburg, stepped down, and by stepped down, I mean was invited to step down. A few days later, the lead counsel was right behind him, retired by the end of the year on New Year's Eve. So still a lot of change, a lot of management changes. The FAA has a lot to say about it. I mean, there's a lot going on with Boeing.
Well, I spoke with you before, you know, the 2019 closed, and you said, this is a story that I know I'm going to still be watching and reporting on. And it's just the twists and turns of it have ceased.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, at this point, the earliest case scenario will be that the 737 MAX is considered flight worthy again in the spring.
Would you ride on one?
See, that's the thing, right? I mean,
can I ask, what kind of plane is this, please? I can't ride on this plane.
At one point, there was a little, I'll have to find out when that was, because this has been like a fire hose of information. But at one point, there was like, okay, we're going to come back in January. If you have qualms about that, we can rebook you. There was kind of that conversation. And then more things started to happen. That's when we had the whistleblower at the plant in South Carolina saying, hey, there was like metal shavings and stuff inside the aircraft where we're installing things. So it's, I mean, again, set aside for a minute that there were 346 fatalities attached to this. At the end of the day, when a long time has passed, this is going to be a really interesting just business case to just look at and say, what in the heck happened, start to finish, even well before the first crash happened, when what happened culturally at Boeing to put it in a position where this, where the domino started to fall this way. I think it's going to be interesting to see that.
A topic that I enjoy, craft beer.
Well, you better enjoy it while you can. No, I shouldn't say it that way.
What are you going to do with my craft beer?
I will do nothing. But in fact, the numbers are looking, they're kind of flat. They're on the downswing for sure. We're looking at something like 23% growth in 2015, now kind of like 10.
Is this because there was such a huge boom and it seemed every neighborhood had their own specialty craft beer brewer?
That's a lot of it. Saturation is part of it. So at that point, what you have is only, you know, the big brands that have like AB InBev or Constellation, like a big backer with national distribution behind them. That's what, you know, you have, you kind of, those are the only people that can kind of push through to shelves and to bar taps, or to beer taps rather, in the bars, and get that attention. Yet we still have more coming. In the last 2 years, you know, like 157 new breweries have entered the market just here.
Well, I see how many pop up as I'm in the suburbs and in the city. And I think to myself, how can we sustain all of these craft breweries? We just had Chicago Inno, the editors from Chicago Inno, in to talk to them. And they were talking about a lot of money that was raised for a spirit-free or zero-proof spirit, or, you know, spirit-free drinks.
No booze.
So there's a movement for being sober, especially spurred on by millennials. So I also wonder if that also affects the craft beer movement. I don't know. Perhaps people aren't wanting to drink as much beer.
I don't know about that, but I do know that a part of that market share went to the hard seltzer crowd, which is an interesting point.
White Claw. That's what comes to mind.
And Truly and those other brands. Look, the Aldi one is fine too. No judgment on the Aldi brand at all.
I love Aldi.
It's totally fine. I enjoy the Aldi. But however, so once you take that, an interesting thing happened, though, with the hard seltzer. They were able to market pretty equally to men and women in a way that even though there were plenty of women that enjoy craft beer, it stayed pretty much male dominated.
I would agree with you there. Definitely.
So, you know, hard seltzer.
Yes.
That's what I'm trying to say. Hard seltzer did take a piece of that market share too. So there's a lot of stuff. Chicago is taking the hit of that national trend of kind of the downswing of craft beer a little bit harder because we're so saturated, because we have such a well-developed market.
Well, Amy, it'll be interesting to see how much this affects the brewery maybe in your neighborhood, or
pick one, like swing a bag over your head and there you're going to hit one in
exactly.
my neighborhood for sure.
We'll see if they end up closing.
It will be interesting. And the Cranes reporter that did this story, he talked to several local breweries that all were kind of like, yeah, a lot of them are kind of making up the difference by opening like a brew pub kind of place,
serving food
and making up the revenue in that way. But, you know, I think for a long time, since probably 2016, people have been saying, like, is this a bubble? Is this going to change? Everything changes. So it's just a matter of what it's going to change into and how people will adapt. But it's an interesting time, right? Because another thing I did on The Gist today was I talked with John Pletz, who has been out since the literal crack of dawn on New Year's Day covering recreational marijuana sales. I opened my eyes that morning and looked at my phone, and I'm like, John Pletz is all over my Twitter timeline. This guy's been outside in very cold weather tweeting and reporting all morning. And so I talked to him about that and of how it looked. $3.2 million the first day in sales with over 77 transactions statewide. A little bit lower on the second day. So he and I really had a conversation about what is normal going to look like once all things are said and done, once we, you know, we're into a place where, okay, it's not taboo, it's not novel. Who's really going to be buying legal weed on the regular it'll be interesting to see. We're not there yet. There's still kind of like an ebb and flow of lines. There's still questions about supply and demand. You can't grow the plant any faster. So it's going to be a few months before a regular steady supply is happening. So that was an interesting conversation about, you know, it's all about vices today on the Daily Gist. We're talking about beer and we're talking about weed.
Only a vice if you're doing it not in moderation, right?
Well, there you go.
True. Okay. Also, let's talk about Next Level Health.
Well, so that's just an interesting healthcare story. There's so much merger acquisition action happening in the healthcare sector right now. And so that's another one. That's a managed care Medicaid plan. So looking at that story, there's another merger there. So we have even fewer options for managed care now. So we're looking at, you know, less than, at one point we had 12, now we're, you know, under 10. So.
Well, thank you, Amy Guth, host of the Crane's Daily Gist. The news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom.